Good evening, and welcome to the Hollywood Outsider. This is your host, Aaron Peterson. Guess what? You're going to hear a different podcast this week. So actually, what we're going to do is introduce another podcast that I do called Presenting Hitchcock. That's right, Presenting Hitchcock. You're also going to hear a very bad or extremely authentic impression of Alfred Hitchcock while we do that. But basically, what it is every single month, I meet with my co-host, Corey Metcalf, and we discuss a different Alfred Hitchcock film. Now, we're doing Psycho for this particular episode. We're introducing you to this podcast through Psycho, but there are many other episodes in the feed if you find Presenting Hitchcock in your podcast feed, or you can go to thehollywoodoutsider.com and there's a Presenting Hitchcock section in the website. But essentially, you know, every month we randomly draw an Alfred Hitchcock movie and we discuss what we see. We go through the movie as a whole, talk about the trivia behind it, and this time it's Psycho. And you may wonder, why Psycho? Well, it's the 60th anniversary of Psycho. I mean, I'm not going to get into the detail because if you listen to the episode, all the detail is there, but it has influenced so many movies. I mean, many, many films that many people don't even realize it has influenced in terms of how films are shot, how films are written, how films are scored, how films are presented, how slasher films work, how horror films work, how thrillers work. There are so many influences from this one film that it's hard to really do it justice without 6 hours of a podcast. But, you know, you got about an hour and 15 minutes here where Corey and I kind of go through in detail everything that we love about the movie Psycho, as well as like some fun facts behind it, and which is always fun. Now, if you listen to last week's episode, you know we had a Psycho contest. That's right, we had a contest for Psycho. If you didn't listen to that episode, what the hell, man? Go back and listen to it. It was a great episode. It was a lot of fun. We talked about TV character exits and some other stuff. So go check out the whole episode. But the reason we're having the Psycho giveaway is because of Universal Pictures Home Entertainment. Because now available is their 4K Ultra HD combo pack of the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection with both a Blu-ray and digital code in that package. That collection has Rear Window. I said it once. I'll say it again. Best movie ever made. I have no doubts about this. Psycho, Vertigo, and The Birds in stunning 4K resolution. The Essential Collection also features hours of bonus features, as well as the original uncut version of Psycho for the first time ever. It comes with a collectible disc book, hours of bonus features, documentaries, expert commentaries, interviews, screen tests, a whole lot more. There's a link to buy your copy of the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection in the show notes. Be sure to pick it up. But we had that contest last week, and we had a ton of submissions. And what we did is we assigned everybody a number. Everybody gets a number assigned. We did a random number generator and we picked our 5 winners. That's right. We had 5. Universal Pictures Home Entertainment gave us 5 digital copies of Psycho. That's how much they want you to know that their classics collection is phenomenal. So definitely go pick it up. We've got 5 winners and I'm going to name them off right now. So get excited. If you entered, get excited. Here it is. You ready? Johan Eriksson, you're a winner, baby. Christina Flores, you're a winner. Stanley Daniel, you're a winner. Paula Sell, you're a winner. Marvin Sewell, you're a winner. Congratulations to everybody that won, and thank you to everybody that entered. I will be in touch personally with each of you to let you know that what your digital code is direct from Universal Pictures Home Entertainment and the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection. Now, all that housekeeping out of the way, what I'm going to present to you is Presenting Hitchcock. Once again, this podcast is once a month. So it's not like every week or every other week. Once a month, we randomly pick a movie, Corey and I, my co-host, and we discuss the trivia, everything behind it that we can, and try to kind of go over. And then we rate it. We give it a rating, and we rate it based on where it rates in terms of Alfred Hitchcock's au revoir and his skill as a director. We also have We find choice quotes from the director himself. We discuss some of our favorite moments and things we didn't like. There's several films that we didn't really like that we discuss as well. The majority we love because Alfred Hitchcock is the greatest director of all time. I said it. But, you know, you can find Presenting Hitchcock in your podcast feed. You can find it at thehollywoodoutsider.com. So wherever you find your podcasts, that's for Presenting Hitchcock. And be careful, there's another one that uses a similar name, but ours is Presenting Hitchcock. And you'll know it because of how it opens with the glorious impression of the director himself, presented by me, the guy known for stellar impressions. Stellar. I mean, this is no Rambo, but it's close. You know what I mean? And it probably goes on a little bit too long, but Corey refuses to cut it because it makes him laugh. So it is what it is. I'm done talking. We'll be back next week. We're going to talk a very interesting topic next week in kind of a relation to Psycho, mental illness in films and entertainment as a whole, as films and TV. And if you want to contribute to that conversation, you can always go to the Hollywood Outsider group on Facebook and or hit us up on Twitter at @BuyPopcorn and be sure to let us know your thoughts on that topic. By the way, thehollywoodoutsider.com, thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's always the website. I'm out of here, guys. I want you to enjoy this episode as we cover Psycho on the Presenting Hitchcock podcast. Please check it out. Please subscribe. There's a ton of other episodes in there. Strangers on a Train is coming next. Okay, and I am out of here. And never forget that a boy's best friend is always his mother.
You've never had an empty moment in your entire life, have you?
Only my share.
Where are you going? I didn't mean to pry.
I'm looking for a private island.
What are you running away from?
Why do you ask that?
No. People never run away from anything. The rain didn't last long, did it? You know what I think? I think that we're all in our private traps, clamped in them, and none of us can ever get out. We scratch and claw, but only at the air, only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch.
Sometimes we deliberately step into those traps.
I was born in mine. I don't mind it anymore.
Oh, but you should. You should mind it.
Oh, I do. But I say I don't.
You know, if anyone ever talked to me the way I heard, the way she spoke to you.
Sometimes when she talks to me like that, I feel I'd like to go up there and curse her and leave her forever. Or at least defy her. But I know I can't.
Good evening, and welcome to Presenting Hitchcock, a podcast devoted to me, Alfred Hitchcock. You can contribute your thoughts and feelings from anywhere across the globe at presentinghitchcock@gmail.com or by searching social media at HitchcockPod. Also, if you are so inclined, you may telephone us at 818-814-6246. I would love to stick around, but you know what I always say. Make your audience suffer as much as possible. Therefore, here are your hosts, Corey and Aaron.
Good evening, and welcome back to Presenting Hitchcock. I'm Corey, and I think I must have one of those faces you can't help believing.
And I'm Aaron. I'm not a fool, and I'm not capable of being fooled, not even by a woman.
Yeah, you're going to watch out for those sneaky women getting around.
Weird thing to say in 2020. The movie we're talking about this time is Psycho. It was released on September 8th, 1960, but premiered at the DeMille Theaters June 16th, 1960. So either way, we are hitting that sweet spot of 60 years of Psycho.
Woo! Happy anniversary, Psycho.
Man, six decades of Bravo. This thing. 6 decades. Film was written by, the screenplay was Joseph Stefano. The book that it was based on was Robert Bloch. And it starred Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, Vera Miles, John Gavin, Martin Balsam, John McIntyre, Simon Oakland, Frank Albertson, and Patricia Hitchcock. In case you didn't know that fun little fact, that was his daughter in The Office, and it was directed by Mr.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes. Oh, man, this is a big one. We didn't even randomly draw this one. We just said, nah, 60 years of Psycho. We're talking about Psycho this month.
Absolutely. And we're hoping we're going to hit that before September. And I think it's pretty exciting, man. I've watched, I don't know about you, but I've watched more Psycho in the last week between documentaries and asides than I have probably in my entire life.
I know. I've been humming the Psycho score all week. It gets in your head. And yeah, I've watched it twice this week. I've watched some side materials and stuff like that. I think we can get into that at the end, give some recommendations on some extra stuff to check out. But yeah, man, I was surprised even this time sitting down watching it that I still get such a thrill from watching this film.
You know, what was fun is I watched it the second time this week with my wife. She's never actually seen the movie because just the title kind of put her off. She's not a big horror movie fan. True story. I mean, even you're with a Hitchcock aficionado, but she's watched a bunch of Hitchcock movies, but never watched Psycho. She just never wanted to. She'd leave the room if I watched it. You know, she just didn't want to watch it. And she finally watched it. And even though she knew basically what the twist was, because, I mean, that's kind of hard to not be spoiled in this day and age on that, she thought it was a great movie. She's like, wow, I didn't think it was as good as it was, and it's not quite as terrifying as I was led to believe. I'm like, well, probably in 1960, it was a lot more terrifying probably than it is now.
That must have been quite the experience. I always love checking out a movie, especially a movie with a twist, with somebody who hasn't seen it before. You know, because you wait for that moment and you look over to check out the reaction, right?
Well, yeah, because I mean, she kind of gave me the feeling that I'm sure audiences in 1960 felt, because about 20 minutes into the movie, she turned to me and said, I thought it was about Norman Bates. Where's Norman Bates? And I'm like, I don't know. What are you talking about? What? You know, you try to play dumb, even though they already know the big secret. But it was pretty fun to watch. I couldn't imagine being in the theater at the time in 1960, because Hitchcock, you know, famously wouldn't let anybody in. So, you know, to have that be a surprise would have been phenomenal at the time.
So shall we get right into it? Because yes. I'm sure we've got a lot to talk about in this recording. So
a lot to talk about. But first, synopsis. Phoenix secretary embezzles $40,000 from her employer's client, goes on the run, and checks into a remote hotel run by a young man under the domination of his mother.
Oh, God, mother, no.
Blood. Blood. Let's do some trivia.
Starting with director cameo. I'm assuming you know where the director cameo is in Psycho.
It was painfully obvious, yeah.
He's standing right outside the real estate office wearing a cowboy hat. I was thought it was a look. Funny one. Yeah, I did read a thing where he wanted to put it like right up top because, you know, he likes playing that game of putting himself in there. But for this one, he just wanted to get it done and out of the way so people weren't trying to look for it. They could focus on the movie a bit more because you kind of have to with this one.
Director Alfred Hitchcock bought the rights to the novel anonymously from Robert Bloch for only $9,000. He then bought up as many copies of the novel as he could to keep the secret ending.
Can you imagine trying to do that today?
Never happened. I don't think you could do it today, do you? With today's technology and spoilers everywhere, I don't think you could.
I know. I doubt you could even buy up all the books anyway, because it'd be digital and it'd be audiobooks. And
true. Yeah. You'd have to find that one writer that's been, you know, I make paper copies out of my house. You know, that's about the only time. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. All right. So the movie in large part was made because Alfred Hitchcock was fed up with the big budget star-studded movies he had recently been making. He wanted to experiment with the more efficient, sparser style of television filmmaking. He ultimately used a crew consisting mostly of television veterans and hired actors and actresses less well-known than those he usually used. Which is direct opposite, I guess, to the last film he made, which was North by Northwest, which we've already talked about. Huge stars, vibrant colors, amazing film. Everyone said pinnacle of Hitchcock's career. Didn't quite peak. Maybe this is more where he actually peaked.
It was funny. I mean, I love to take credit for it, but it wasn't my analogy. But 78-52, I think, is where it was, where they talked about North by Northwest. He blatantly shows the train going into the tunnel, and then Psycho opens post-coitus. And it's just like, that felt like a total Hitchcock thing.
Yeah, he did call Psycho a big joke on the audience, so.
You never know. You know what? It was also funny is if you go and you dig a little deeper and find some interviews and whatnot, it really seemed like he was getting a bit tired of other filmmakers evoking his style and kind of being crowned the next Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to go and show low-budget horror auteurs how it's done. So he made this movie less than $1 million, and, you know, blew the doors off, saying basically, I think I do this better than you guys.
Yeah, hilarious.
When the cast and crew began work on the first day, they had to raise their right hands and promise not to divulge one word of the story. Sir Alfred Hitchcock also withheld the ending part of the script from his cast until he needed to shoot it, which I think is very important because it probably amped up their playing of that story. Big surprise.
Yeah, yeah. Again, like, is it something you can do today? Maybe. Yeah, if it's a small enough casting crew.
If it's just a screenplay, I think you could do it. You could do that. It's, if you're based on anything, I don't see it's possible.
Mm-mm. Anyway, so Paramount Pictures gave Alfred Hitchcock a very small budget with which to work on this film because of their distaste with the source material. They also deferred most of the box office take to Hitchcock himself, thinking the movie would probably fail. When it became a sleeper hit, Hitchcock made a fortune.
Good. Good on him.
Yeah, he actually, I think he gave up his fee in order to direct it back into the budget and in return got a percentage.
That's what James Cameron thought he was doing with Titanic, and it didn't work out as great for him. This was Sir Alfred Hitchcock's last theatrical movie in black and white. It was filmed from November 30th, 1959 to February 1st, 1960. And it's interesting to point out, he could have filmed it in color because you'll notice that several of his movies before this were in color. He chose to go black and white because of the blood and because of some other things that are in the movie. That
cost as well. It's cheaper.
Yep, much cheaper. Black and white is cheaper.
So Joseph Stefano was adamant about seeing a toilet on screen to display realism. He also wanted to see it flush. Alfred Hitchcock told him he had to, quote unquote, make it so through his writing if he wanted to actually see it. So Stefano wrote the scene in which Marion adds up the money, then flushes the paper down the toilet specifically. So the toilet flushing was integral to the scene and therefore irremovable. This was the first American movie and possibly first fictional movie ever to show a toilet flushing on screen. I've always loved that bit of trivia. Hack a bitch to death in the shower. Go for it, but don't flush a toilet.
I've never understood it. It's kind of like the never show married couple in the same bed. And the, like, how uptight were we?
It's American films for you though, right? You could slaughter a woman all you want, just as long as she's not naked too much.
Yeah, and you can still get that PG-13 rating, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So weird, but don't show a toilet. Like, what? Where do you think people are doing in the bathroom all day? Like, in the 50s and 60s?
They're in there fully dressed all the time. Nobody's ever naked. Any sensible person. When are you ever naked?
They come out in a suit. I don't. I shower fully clothed every time.
I came out of the womb in a suit.
That would have been a weird birth.
Hello, Mom and Dad.
Hello, Mother.
The shot of Arbogast falling backward down the stairs was a process shot of Martin Balsam sitting stationary and waving his arms as if losing his balance in front of a screen projecting a previously filmed dolly shot moving down the stairs. Still really holds up, even 60 years later, too, by the way.
I know. Everybody focused on the shower scene and everything, but there were some other remarkable shots in this film.
Oh, absolutely. Some wonderful shots. There's a lot of we'll talk about those.
So in total, three actresses recorded for Norma Bates's dialogue. Their recordings were then mixed together until Alfred Hitchcock found the right tone of voice for each particular scene. Apparently, sometimes in some sentences, it's all three.
Really? I didn't know.
He cuts it down like by word for word.
When Norman spies on Marion as she gets ready to shower, you peeping Tom. The painting he removes from the parlor wall is of Susanna and the Elders, in which a young woman is unknowingly watched as she bathes. Yeah, you look at that painting, unknowingly? I mean, they're basically like just staring at her in the face.
Yeah, I know. Like, apparently it's a more salacious version of that scene where they're like right up close on her, like almost touching her, I guess, or like actually touching her.
Violating her space.
Yeah, exactly.
Metaphorical ways.
So the shower scene was shot from December 17 through December 23, 1959. It features 77 different camera angles and includes 50 cuts. I mean, this scene has been looked into to absolute death, if you pardon the pun.
I mean, a whole documentary on just the shower scene.
I know,
which is
right?
Fantastic.
Like they cut it down to like even show you how quickly shots move, right? Like when it gets to the attack and everything, and they show you it's like this shot 7 frames, that shot 11 frames, next shot 7 frames, like it. Just to show you like how quickly the guy cuts and what angles he cuts to. So yeah.
And they even showed the in the documentary the one scene or the one cut that
Hitch pulled from the film because he was afraid he couldn't get it through the censors. And they used it in that Psycho God Awful remake where Anne Hesh basically is a overhead shot and she's bent over the tub as she's dying, which I don't think was needed in this movie. I think you got the point across very well. The way that he shot it.
I saw an article that they're going to be doing a re-release of Psycho soon, and they're going to put in some of the more salacious shots. And everyone's just like, why though? Like, apparently,
yeah,
there's not a lot surviving. So whatever you do put back in, is it needed? And would it just ruin what's already there?
Exactly. And if people are like, wow, you're still talking on trivia, you're not to the movie yet? Yeah, this movie's popular and it's got quite the history. Bear with us. Next up, the shot of the knife appearing to enter Marion's abdomen was achieved by pressing it against her body so as to dent the skin slightly, withdrawing it rapidly, and then playing that shot backwards. Which I will tell you, I never really felt like it looked like the knife went in, but some people did think that.
Well, you look at it from a modern perspective. It's tame, but
true.
For the time, I mean, genius.
I think it was the first belly button on screen or something like that.
It's funny, you see all the films of like women in bikinis and stuff, but they're like high-waisted.
So weird. I just don't understand our uptight nature. Just weird.
The side boob in that shot too, so slip that past them too.
If I had to pick a favorite, I'm just kidding.
All right, so at the end of the shower scene, the first few seconds of the camera pullback from Janet Leigh's face is actually a freeze frame. Alfred Hitchcock did this because while viewing the rushes, his wife noticed the pulse in Janet Leigh's neck throbbing. And you can still kind of see it if you really focus on her neck. You can see her neck throbbing there, but what can you do? I mean, seriously.
You want to know what's funny, Corey? This is true and attributed to you, so thanks for ruining the movie for me. I watched the movie earlier this week. I didn't notice that, really. And I've seen this movie 50 times, probably. I read your notes. I'm watching again with more of a critical eye, and I'm like, that's so obvious. You can see her neck throb. Which doesn't take you out of it because she still, at that point, just died. So, I mean, it would totally make sense, even if she was a real corpse. But I wouldn't have noticed that if you wouldn't have pointed that out. So now people are going to go watch this movie again and you're going
to
see it.
Yeah, it also has to cut back to the shower head real quick. Apparently she takes a breath in that shot and he didn't have a backup. So he had to snip out that little section and put in a little shot back to the shower head real quick.
I mean, she's only human. Director Sir Alfred Hitchcock was so pleased with the score written by Bernard Herrmann that he doubled the composer's salary to $34,501. Hitchcock later said 33% of the effect of Psycho was due to the music. He's right.
Does that mean that his salary, they tacked on an extra 50 cents for some reason? $34,501, halved.
Oh.
Why would they put an extra 50 cents on his salary?
It's a good question. It must have been like whatever the base salary, like a union thing at the time or something along those lines.
Bernard Herrmann wrote the main title theme before Saul Bass created the opening credit sequence. Bass animated it to the music, creating the stabbing, wrenching look.
I love that look.
It's pretty interesting, right? Because, I mean, Saul Bass, great openings, right? But to know that he actually made this one to go with the music, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's done a lot of great credits. Bernard Herrmann achieved the shrieking sound of the shower scene by having a group of violinists saw the same note over and over. He called the motif a return to pure ice water. I don't even understand what that means. But I think I get it, but I don't get it, but I kind
of
get it.
It might be where that myth of the cold water comes from. You know, everyone goes, oh, Alfred Hitchcock like surprised Janet Leigh with ice cold water to get her scream. Apparently, yeah. It's just not true.
Yeah, it's not true. Janet Leigh herself said that's not true. So I don't know why do people insist with these these rumors and innuendos, and it's just like that. But you ask the actual people, and they say no, that never happened.
It's an interesting story, and it would be great if it was true. It's just not.
Sure, I think people just want a mythology.
Yeah. So in the famous interview with Alfred Hitchcock, Francois Truffaut commented that the scenes with the sheriff were let down. Hitchcock replied, "The sheriff's intervention comes under the heading of what we have discussed many times before. Why don't they go to the police?" I've always replied, "They don't go to the police because it's dull. Here is a perfect example of what happens when they go to the police."
Absolutely.
They are inept and do nothing.
Absolutely. But on the same token, like, I get where the cop was coming from. I mean, I get where he was coming from. He's just like, based on what he knows, that seems like a weird story. It just seemed like a fishy story to him. Should have investigated it better.
But. I know. Like, the cop that stops her and talks to her and follows her does more than even the sheriff does. That's hilarious.
And that cop gave up. We'll come back to that cop because he's an interesting guy. Once we're almost to the movie, I promise. $40,000, the amount stolen by Marion Crane, Janet Leigh, is the same amount deposited in the bank by Uncle Charlie, who's played by Joseph Cotton in Shadow of a Doubt. That's a fun fact.
That's pretty good. I like that. When I read that, I was like, that's clever. I love it.
Cheap shout out to ourselves. Go listen to that episode. Shadow of a Doubt.
So every theater that showed this movie had a cardboard cutout installed in the lobby of Alfred Hitchcock, pointing to his wristwatch with a note saying, "The manager of this theater has been instructed at the risk of his life not to admit to the theater any persons after the picture starts. Any spurious attempts to enter by side doors, fire escapes, or ventilating shafts will be met by force. The entire objective of this extraordinary policy, of course, is to help you enjoy Psycho more." Just seems like something he wrote up, right?
Yeah, and it worked. It worked. I mean, that's how you create demand, right? I couldn't get in. Oh, man, I got to see this movie. I got to see it. I got to see it before my friends ruin it for me.
And we've talked about some of these gimmicks that he pulled in the theater, right? Like, it was...
Right.
He was selling you all the way into the theater, right? Just no matter where you were going, you were still being sold how good his movie is.
Well, speaking of selling, in later interviews, Alfred Hitchcock and Janet Leigh both categorically stated it was her body in the shower scene. Janet Leigh later admitted in the making of Psycho that it wasn't. And it wasn't. The body belonged to a model called Marley Renfro. When you can't see Leigh's face in the shots, you're looking at her body double. She only made $500 for filming what would become one of the most iconic movie scenes ever. And just to give you a little background, she was a Dallas-born stripper who worked in Las Vegas. Renfro was one of the first Playboy bunnies. And apart from Psycho, she only appeared in one other film, Francis Ford Coppola's 1962 soft porn comedy western, Tonight for Sure. Fun facts.
She was interviewed for the documentary, so...
7852, she sure was, yep.
That's right. She lets you know exactly where she is and where Janet Leigh is.
She's like, "That's my side boob. I own that side boob. Mine."
Anthony Perkins and Janet Leigh said that they did not mind being stereotyped forever because of their participation in this movie. They said in interviews they would rather be stereotyped and be remembered forever for this classic movie than not be remembered at all. And it's true. Anthony Perkins was totally stereotyped after this.
He did. And I got to say, he's a great actor. I mean, yes, he was great in this movie, but he's also great as an actor as a whole. I mean, if you just watch some of his other work, he was a very talented man. I hope people find some of his other stuff. This movie marked the fifth and final time that Sir Alfred Hitchcock earned an Oscar nomination for Best Director, though he never won. He was given basically an honorary Oscar later on. They're like, "Hey, sorry, guy, we couldn't get you a real one. Here's your Lifetime Achievement Award."
I don't know. Those are still nice to get, I suppose. All right, last bit of trivia here. This one relates to Jamie Lee Curtis, Janet Leigh's daughter, of course. She was born in 1958, right before Psycho started pre-production. Curtis would grow up to be cinema's top scream queen, in part because of her mum and this movie. Erwin Yablans, John Carpenter, and Deborah Hill, who all did the casting for Halloween, admitted they chose Jamie Lee Curtis, in part because of the stunt casting aspect, and this would then tie Halloween together with Psycho in the public's mind. Curtis would go on to star in The Fog, Prom Night, Terror Train, Halloween 2, more horror movies of different franchises than any other actress in Hollywood at the time.
And is still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still doing
they,
it.
They just pushed back Halloween Kills to next year. I'm devastated.
Thanks, Corona.
I don't want to wait another year. Damn Corona.
That's funny. And it's funny if you look in a little bit of Jamie Lee Curtis's history. She's been asked to do that shower scene in various ways, hundreds of times. And she always said no. I think she just did it for Scream Queens or something like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a joke.
Years back. Yeah. Yep. It was a good show. I like that. It's very
love the first season. And then I didn't like anything in the second season.
Yeah, and then they canceled it, but it was a good show. I enjoyed it.
You know what? It's time to talk about the movie. That's how much of a footprint this movie has left on the world. So we're going to go through this movie and what happens, and tell me if you've heard this before. Ready?
Let's do it.
All right. So we open with Marion Crane. She wants to be with her lover, Sam Loomis, but he's too broke for alimony payments to treat her the way that she deserves. He also lives in Fairvale, which is quite a distance from where she is. Well, Marion is fed up by all this and decides to make a different play at life by stealing $40,000 from her employer that she was supposed to deposit for a client buying a house for his daughter. She hits the road to Fairvale, where Sam Loomis lives. And in case you missed it, yes, this is where Halloween's Dr. Loomis gets his name from this very movie. Yes. One of the most beautiful elements of Psycho for me is how, for the uninitiated, this seems like a completely different kind of film by this first section. Like, it's almost a crime film. Do you agree that that still holds up so many years later? I mean, I talked about my wife saying that, and I didn't know when you first saw it. Did you feel like that was a diversion that worked?
You know, in retrospect, no. I think everything that happens here in the beginning is just all foreshadowing. It's all taking us towards Marion's fate. Her fate is to die in this film, and just every little detail in this is taking us in that direction. I think that's the great thing. Like, 60 years old, this film, right? So yes, it has been analyzed in every which way, but it's true. Everything they say about this is true. And the film needs this whole opening sequence, or else the shower scene doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely true.
I love from the get-go as well, the bird motif, right? Because we've talked about the birds. It's the film he does right after this film. There is so much about birds in this movie. It's crazy. From the get-go, Marion Crane from Phoenix, you know? It's just, let's get us in with the birds.
You eat like a bird. There's a lot of birds. He stuffs birds.
And then we go into a hotel room. Again, foreshadowing. Just everything. Her conversation with Sam, she mentions her own mother in this conversation. There's just so many little details that they don't dwell on. It is just normal conversation, everything, but it's just layering everything to take us where we need to go. I love it. It's so natural. This opening, you get to know her and Sam and the deal. He's married, divorced, so they're being a bit secretive because, you know, what would people say, divorcee with a woman and all this sort of stuff. Like, wonderful setup, you know, and it just, you get to know her and you feel for her, and she's going to go ahead and she's going to be a bit impulsive.
Stupid is the word I'd go with, but yeah, impulsive.
I know, it's not the crime of the century, right? I think that she, if her fate hadn't befallen her, I seriously doubt she would have gotten away with this crime.
In one other aspect, I like the, you know, especially back in this era, there's a lot of play with the black hat, white hat motif, you know, with Westerns and whatnot. Good guys wear the white hats, bad guys wear the black hats. And this does the same thing with lingerie. So she's a good girl. She's wearing the white brassiere and whatnot. And then she takes the money, and then her brassiere switches to a black one. It was an interesting dynamic and a color motif that Hitchcock was playing with.
And I even like the office scene. This guy comes in with his $40,000. He's buying a house, cash.
Bragging like crazy.
But that in itself, it's going to be like her conversation, I guess, with Norman later, to the extent of she does something to men, right? That gets them a bit flirty with her or something like that.
Well, she's beautiful. That helps.
So you even get that kind of setup as well, the way that men act around her and how, I don't want to say familiar she gets with them, but she's effortless, really. Like, she doesn't have to do anything and men seem to be attracted to her.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, honestly, she's very nice to Norman. She's polite. She doesn't do anything flirty at all. The gentleman in the office with the 40 grand, I mean, she was being downright ignoring him. She was just kind of being rude and curt to him in many respects. Like, she didn't play a game at all. And he's still fawning over her. So she just, because she's a very pretty woman, I'm sure that helped, you know?
Well, and I think that's the setup too, right? When someone like this dude talks to her, of course she's not going to give him time of day. He's a bit of a slob coming on to her a little bit, you know? But then, you know, Norman, he's a nice guy. So, you know, he's less threatening, you know? He's less forward, preparing us, right? It's setting up expectations. A slob talks to her and it's gross and weird, but this nice guy talks to her and it's even weirder.
Well, and you spoke of foreshadowing. Hitchcock's daughter, who plays Carolyn in the movie, and the other office girl, she mentions her mother. You know, I mean, it's just, there's this constant foreshadowing to what's coming if you really, really pay attention, especially once you've seen the movie and you know to look for it. You know, there's definitely a lot of foreshadowing.
She also does a throwaway line about her sister going out of town as well. So you kind of get that set up for the second half of the film.
Which you can tell they're related, man. They're both very headstrong and determined. And they seem like sisters when the movie plays out, which is nice. Because a lot of times in movies like this, they don't seem like they're related.
Oh, yeah. Considering they're never on screen together. It's pretty good, yeah.
So along the way, Marianne is pulled over and scared by a police officer. Then she goes to buy a new car randomly, which I thought was a real dramatic turn of events. And while she's there, the cop pulls across the street and then pulls into the car lot as she pulls out of it. That's my only question in terms of the police officer is he was obviously not trusting anything about her. Why wouldn't he just keep following her or pull her over again, question her some more? I mean, he basically just let her out of his sight.
Well, this is why I totally think that she would never have gotten away with this crime. She's asleep in her car. He comes and wakes her up and she immediately tries to leave. Like she starts up the engine and he's like, hey, don't go anywhere. I'm a police officer. Like, I obviously want to talk to you.
Yeah. Don't you see my sunglasses? These are police sunglasses. Hello.
Yeah. And then she just makes mistake after mistake, right? But I think the main point of this police officer is that he actually gives her what should be pretty sound advice, which is maybe next time grab a hotel room. But because she does that, it directly leads to her death. Again, like fascinating stuff, you know, it's just a policeman. A policeman tells you to do something and you do it and it doesn't really work out very well.
So Marianne hits the road again. She's got a new car. She spent money on this new car. I still don't get why she had to buy a new car, but okay. She wants to start a new life. So she hits the road. A rainstorm hits. It forces Marianne to pull over and find shelter at the Bates Motel, which is a seedy little motel with a huge, beautiful, kind of, yet very eerie house overlooking the property. There's something special about that house, and I don't know if it's the architecture. I don't know if it's the way that it looks like a mother and how it's always looking at the hotel, like it's overlooking that hotel. There's just something very dominant about that house and the way that it's designed. And she arrives there, and officially, she's on the lam, and here we have Marianne Crane meeting Norman Bates for the first time.
This whole section, again, it just hits you with the foreshadowing, right? Like the fact that it starts to rain, that's just like the shower scene coming down.
Mm-hmm.
She has to go and hit the horn so Norman can come down and he says, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you in all this rain. Just like what's going to happen to her in the shower, right? She doesn't hear him coming in because she's got all that water running. It's so fascinating to think about this whole setup. He's just such a nice guy. He brings an umbrella for her and brings her some food and all that sort of stuff. Like, it's like super, like, just non-threatening at all.
Yeah, and I want to talk about, well, here, I want to mention this real quick, but Norman invites Marianne to dinner. She's got nowhere else to go, so she accepts. And then, of course, she hears her mother scolding Norman while he's getting food ready. They adjourn to Norman's parlor where they exchange pleasantries, and we see that Norman loves animals and taxidermy. And when we get a little bit more backstory on Norman, his father died when he was 5. She raised him. His mother raised him. Another man enters and talked mom into buying this motel. And then her lover died too. And now Norman is alone taking care of his mother. Now, we got a whole lot of character in here, especially what happens next, because Marianne suggests putting mother in this institution. Norman loses it a bit over this. That's where you see a side of him that you hadn't seen to this point, because he's this very charming, innocent, gawkish man. I mean, he's very slight as a person. And so he loses it a little bit. You know, who can blame him? We all go a little mad sometimes. Marianne retires, he gawks through a peephole, and then we get to what's coming next, and we'll get to that in a second. But I just want to talk about Anthony Perkins. You know, I talked about how good an actor he is, and I think this section of the film, which is probably a good 10 minutes or so as we meet Norman Bates, and we don't really know we're supposed to be fearful of him at this point, he does such a masterful job of making us sympathetic to him. Even after I've seen this movie so many times, I still find myself somewhat empathetic to the character of Norman Bates because of his performance, because he just seems like such a almost like a abused housewife syndrome. He just seems like such a victim in many ways. And I know that's probably not fair because he's a serial killer. On the same token, it's how he plays it that captures that, innocence that's still in there somewhere that unfortunately was just abused out of him.
Oh, he's childlike in so many of his actions. Like, it's funny because they have this conversation and it seems like a perfectly fine adult conversation. She does say, you know, maybe you might want to put her somewhere, and he kind of goes with that for a moment. moment, right? He says, you know, I might, you know, sometimes I feel like I might curse her and just leave her forever, but I couldn't do that because then she'd be left here alone. And when it gets to it, he kind of gets a bit angry at her and her suggestion, but ultimately she goes back to her room and he runs back up to the house. And you see this moment where he goes to walk upstairs, but instead of going upstairs, he goes and he sits down in the kitchen and kind of gets this like sulky look on his face, right? Like a little boy that's just been like chastised.
Like he's in timeout. Oh, okay, yeah. Mom, I'll go sit in the kitchen. Yeah, I mean, he's chastising himself mentally. Yeah.
But. And in retrospect, I mean, you realize that he's going to go upstairs to maybe say hello to Mother, but he knows that she's not really up there. And that's maybe why he goes to have a sulk.
He's got a debate. Do I need that dress on yet? Do I wait a little bit so she's in the shower? When do I get the dress and go down there?
It's another scene that has to happen.
And what I like about what Hitchcock does here, especially with the scene with Marion and Norman, is, you know, a lot of movies that tried to replicate Psycho and years later would almost paint the victims as getting what's coming to them or something in certain way. I mean, Friday 13th, I love those movies, but they're notorious for people have sex, they become victims. You know, there's some way that, well, if you wouldn't have done that, you wouldn't be in the crosshairs. Marion does absolutely nothing wrong. You know, he paints his heroine as a very nice person who made a bad error in judgment. Simple as that. She just went to the wrong place at the wrong time, and the worst circumstances befitted her.
She was absolutely too impulsive.
Yeah, but she didn't do anything and deserved what she got.
She just had this idea of getting married, living their life, starting their life together, and she thought that this money would help with that. She's realized that maybe by doing that, she's actually ruining her life rather than starting a new one, you know? It's like she knows she's not going to get away with it. And this little chat that she has with Norman brings her around on that, because she goes back into her room.
Does the totaling.
She does a bit of math. I think she's trying to figure out, how can I pay back that $700 and get the money back by the time the office opens on Monday? It also allows for a little bit of evidence to get caught in the toilet there.
And also make sure the toilet's in there too. You know, it's very important. We get the toilet in there.
But yeah, I think at this point she's definitely thinking of heading back. I don't even think she should be in this hotel. That's her main mistake, right? I know the police officer told her she should grab a hotel room. She doesn't want to run in with the law again, for sure. But I mean, when she arrives there, she finds out she's only 15 miles away from Fairvale. Like, she should have just got back in a car and driven it. Like, how long does it take you to drive 15 miles, really?
Well, at the time when she got the room, it was a rainstorm. So she didn't want to drive all night in that. And then it cleared up rather quickly. Yeah. Should she have got back in the car? Yeah, but at that point, she's comfortable. She's meet this nice boy, and she just wants to relax for a little bit and have a talk. She doesn't realize he's a loon. And then, yeah, I agree with you. She does the math, and I think she would have taken that money back and just repaid what she stole. Yeah, with their stupid new car.
Well, that's just it. I mean, she could have gotten that $700 back. She'd probably have to sell her car in order to do it, but
yeah,
she could have gotten that money back before anybody had caught on to her having taken it in the first place. But that's not going to happen, because the money doesn't mean anything.
And you know, it's Norman who was gawking through that peephole that caused the reaction in him that made him shoot back to the house and have his moment where he decided to go grab his version of a Batman costume and come back down. And we arrive at one of the most iconic scenes in film history. The shower scene itself, which is interesting because it uses the safe space to terrify audiences, because back then, you know, people felt very comfortable in their homes. And this is, even though it's not a home, the bathroom is always like our safe space. I mean, everybody listening, you know, you've done it. I mean, you want to get away from everybody. You just go to the bathroom, you close the door, and you just, I'll just search my phone, or I'll take a shower, a really long shower, whatever it is. That's where you relax. That is a safe space. And it made this terrifying for people, because Marion is in the shower, and that's the first time, you know, since she was with Sam that she appears happy. She's smiling the whole time. I mean, she's enjoying it, lathering up. She's having a great time. And then we get the door slowly opening. We get the absence of music for a time. We get the shower curtain pulling back. And then we get the multiple cuts to the score, the stabbing sound, the pulsating score, the obscuring of the killer's face, the syrup for blood, the pullback on Lee's cold, lifeless face. Like, everything about this scene is perfect and perfectly realized. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, the pinnacle of everything Hitchcock has known about filmmaking. I mean, you got to think, at this point in his career, 35 years into his filmmaking career, through the black and white silent films into, you know, the modern era of filmmaking all the way to this scene. And it is just a masterwork of direction, storyboarding, editing. Of course, you cannot discount Bernard Herrmann's score, but the way that that kicks in, like starting the scene silent and then the ripping open of that curtain with the metal rings against the metal bar to just kick off that score, and then the frenzied attack on her with shots that are out of focus and jump cuts and all kinds of stuff just throwing you right off kilter. Like, it's one of the most iconic scenes in cinema history for a reason. It's brilliant.
What's funny is if you know, like watching the documentary 7852, we've talked about that several times because it does do a good job of analyzing the scene, but you see throughout it so many nods to this scene, so many nods in film history and movies and TV itself. I mean, both forms of entertainment. This scene has been emulated. There are tons of photographers who have emulated these shots, you know, where you have her holding the curtain or you have somebody else holding the curtain. You know, everybody wants to emulate this scene. It is one of the most famous scenes in film history. And I would dare say it's got to be, if not the most famous, at least in the top five most iconic scenes in film history.
Watching, you know, filmmakers and editors and stuff talk about this scene, pointing out things that you don't even think of. Like, how do you point a camera right at a shower head, which is turned on, and have it not wet the lens? Like, there is a shot that looks directly up at the shower head running. And you're just like, I never even thought about that. How is all that water running out of the shower head and it's not hitting the camera at all?
And one thing I found, because I rewatched it, like I said, twice this week. One thing I found fascinating is a lot of times when I've seen films originally and I saw the iconic scene, I'm like, okay, I get it. I get why that's iconic. And then you go back many, many years later and rewatch it, especially if you have a critical eye, you can kind of pick it apart. I can't really pick this one apart. I don't find anything wrong with it. It's just a masterfully done scene. Even today, even after seeing it, even if it's black and white, it's 60 years old. By all accounts, this should not be as enthralling anymore because I've seen it 50 times. It's black and white. I haven't, you know, they don't make black and white anything anymore unless you're trying to be artisty. And it's still, it just takes me in, sucks me in. And even though I'm trying to watch it with a critical eye, I get sucked into the moment. You know, I'm fearful for Marion Crane. Even though I know who that is, I still am like, maybe it's Mother. You know, I mean, just like, there's just a little tiny piece of my head that goes, maybe that was Mother. You know, it's just a fascinating thing to watch, especially so many years later.
And then the way it ends with the pullback from her extreme close up on her eye. Yeah, it starts as a still image while they do the spiral and then come back. But once they pull back and you see the water dripping off her face and you're like, oh, you know, it's not a still. That is actual footage. And he had to troubleshoot a way to pull this shot off because cameras are freaking huge at this time. Like, how would you do that? And then to pull away from her, you see the money that she wrapped up in the newspaper and then look up at the house and hear Norman discover blood
on Mama's clothes or whatever. Yeah.
And come running down to be the dutiful son to clean up the crime scene. You know, it's just, you know, to watch Norman do this whole cleanup. I mean, you cannot help but feel like you have been pulled into this scene and that you have been a part of this attack on this woman. And now you feel like you can, you know, stop holding your breath. But I mean, what kind of relief do you get from seeing someone clean up a murder scene? You know,
like, it's very disturbing. Yeah, it's very disturbing.
It goes all the way out to him disposing of the body before you can kind of feel like, holy shit, that's over, that's done. And not only that, but the main character is dead. Like, what the fuck do we do now?
Yeah.
I guess Norman's the main character, right? How do we feel about him? Because you don't know he's the killer, obviously. I mean, you know.
No, if you've never seen it and you don't know the backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then that's just it. They're saying, like, I'm trying to make you feel for Norman now. This is a guy who was had to clean up a murder committed by his mother. And you kind of feel like he's been put upon.
This poor kid. His mom, look what she did to him. Yeah, yeah. And now he's got to do this like any dutiful son would. And if you really want to know why the scene works so well, go rewatch the shot-for-shot remake. And realize there's no emotion you'll have watching that. It shows how important it is to have a master filmmaker behind the camera because the soul is not in that scene. And it's shot for shot. Like, it's cut the exact same way. It's shot the exact same way. And yet it has zero of the power of the scene in black and white.
It's proof that a director imbues themselves into what they're making. Yeah, you feel Gus Van Sant's presence. in his film, and it's not as good as what Hitchcock did.
No, it's not.
It's just not.
There's a reason why that movie is not a big part of this episode.
It's offensive. That's why.
Yes, very much so. And you know, in some circles, I want to point this out. Storyboard artist Saul Bass was attributed as directing the scene himself, but Hitchcock directed the entirety of the scene. Everybody involved with the film has stated that. So just to clarify that, Saul Bass storyboarded it. That's it.
Yeah. And apparently it's sort of like the storyboard, but not really.
All right. So now the movie changes. We go into a different aspect of it because Norman's already cleaned up the scene. He goes back to life as he knew it. And we meet Lila finally. And then Sam returns. And then we meet Detective Milton Abrogast. And he is basically the guy that's been sent to find out what happened to Marion Crane. Where'd she take that money?
I love this, that Lila walks on into Sam's hardware store. There's this friggin' Karen there talking about insect spray. She's a total Karen, right? Oh, is it painless? Which, I mean, that's hilarious, right? Insect or man, death should always be painless. We've literally just watched a woman get hacked to death in a shower. But yeah, Lila walks on in. Where's Marion? Is she here? And then a private investigator walks on in. He's just like, I'm Abrogast. I've been hired to find her. I know she's not here, but I'm gonna go and find her. All right, bye. That's how this scene plays out, essentially.
It does a wonderful job of because we don't know two of these characters. We really don't know all three of them very well. We at least have an introduction to Sam. We don't know anything about Lila except from what Marion said, and we don't know Milton Abrogast at all. In literally 5 minutes, they have managed to make us feel for these characters and be invested in their play. And that to me is very impressive. And I don't feel like it's mentioned enough when people talk about Psycho. You know, the performances all across the board are strong, but I really feel like Lila and Abrogast are the characters that have the hardest time selling their version of why they're there. And they do it in the quickest amount of time with zero problems. Like, that's how strong their performances are, because we're immediately invested.
I'm invested in them. I do like the Abrogast character. When he calls later after speaking to Norman, I do get a sense that, I don't know, they're trying to sell their friendship a bit more than it is.
Because they're not really friends, right?
Yeah, you know, he kind of calls up and when he talks to her on the phone, and it kind of just seems like, I don't know, it's like he's working for her or something. And you're like, but no, he was hired by the guy who was going to buy the house, right? To get his $40,000 back. That's who his client is. Why is he so chummy with Lila in that scene, you know? So that's like one part that's always kind of not sat well with me, but that's like the tiniest of nitpicks.
I mean, he cares about the play. You know, he goes through, he's the guy that puts everything together, by the way. He goes to all of these motels. And like you said, he stops at the Bates Motel and meets Norman. He's very suspicious. So he does call Lila because apparently, like you said, they're besties now. And then he heads back to talk to Mother because he saw the mother in the house. And he wanted to find out if she knew anything, you know, and I think partly he thought maybe that is actually Marion Crane up there.
I mean, his initial encounter with Norman, I think, is actually his best scene.
Great investigator. Great interrogator.
Exactly. He doesn't give anything away. You feel like he's tripping up Norman. And even though Norman's like, not a lot of people come around here and you kind of forget and everything like that. Like, he could be, hey, got you, or, you know, hey, I caught you out. But he's just like, oh, yep. No, I understand. So tell me about her. What happened while she was here, you know? And he's trying to get him to talk more. And Norman's not coming up with very good explanations for why he didn't remember her, right? He's like, oh, she had wet hair and this isn't a very good photo. And she was actually back there and we sat down, we talked and we had a sandwich. And he's like, how did you sit down and talk to this woman but not remember that she was here, you know? Like, Abrogast knows that something happened here, and he gets a lot of information out of Norman, which I don't think he intended to let Abrogast get.
No, I don't think he did either. And you can't remember Janet Leigh came into your place? Come on. Oh, she's different. She had hair that was wet. What?
It was just last week.
You know, time, it just gets away from you out here in the middle of nowhere. Sure it does. Well, it leads to Abrogast breaking into the Bates house and sneaking upstairs to try to meet Mother. Well, he meets her, and she stabs his ass and knocks him down a beautiful flight of stairs with that shot we talked about earlier.
How often do you see someone stabbed in the face? You never see that in a movie. Oh, it's like a vulnerable spot right in the face.
Yeah, that's not, you don't want to see it. And I will say, I have very, very little critique about this movie. To me, it's as close to a perfect movie as you can get in most respects. I do have that thing when I still watch this movie where it always kind of bothers me Because when you see Mother attack Arbogast at the top of the stairs, she's going low. Like, it's more midsection. And somehow, when you see the face is what gets slashed. You know, I just let it go. But every time I watch it, I'm like, that's not where she's stabbing.
Oh, you did pick in that. I mean, the guy somehow manages to fumble, still standing, all the way down to the bottom of the stairs. He doesn't even fall over down the stairs. No, he tumbles on his feet down there.
Still, that one always bothered me. Like, he went low. What are you doing? Or she went low. Sorry. What are you doing?
It's still a great shot, though, right? It's
I love it.
God's eye looking straight down on top of her as she runs out and slashes at him. Just, oh, it still gets me. Seriously, just cut right across the face like that. Jeez.
Poor guy. Should have known better, man. Should take backup. Well, Lila and Sam are now even more suspicious. So they head to the sheriff. And like you talked about earlier, the sheriff is very dull, you know, but he does kind of inform us about Norman. Like, his mother died years ago. And she knows, or they know, because Mrs. Sheriff basically was there, and she was wearing, what, periwinkle blue or something like that?
Periwinkle blue.
So Mom died. She was poisoned, or no, she poisoned her lover, and then herself is what they think. That's not actually what happened. Norman did it.
Yeah. Norman killed them both. Yeah, this cop's just not interested. He even calls up Norman, asks him, he goes, oh, was there a guy there? And then he kind of just takes Norman at his word, right? When he goes around, he's just like, oh, yeah, he said he was there, asked him some questions, then he left.
I mean,
I believe what Norman says over what you two say.
To be fair, I still say, like, I get where the sheriff's coming from. He's known that since he was a little kid, so he's got no reason to doubt Norman at this point.
But he can't even say Arbogast name right.
Arbogast?
Yeah, exactly. Like, every time I hear that, it's just like, was there a fella out there, a private investigator? What was his name? And he goes, Arbogast. And he goes, Arbogast. I'm like, dude, he literally just said it's pronounced Arbogast. You don't need to, like, sound it out.
He's very phonetic in how he speaks.
But it shows how inept he is. And then they want to go out with him the next morning. And he's like, oh, yeah, I've already been out there. I talked to him.
Oh, yeah, when they see him at the church, yeah.
He even let me look around. Like, there's nothing out there. Don't bother. And so that means they're going to go out there by themselves. Lila's like, I want to see this. And I want to speak to that mother. If his mother or whoever it is out there, I want to go and talk to them. So it gives them a reason to go out without the police.
And obviously, Sheriff never checked the fruit cellar because that's where you would have found Mom. Well, they do. They go out to the Bates Motel. They check in as man and wife to snoop around. I feel like Norman seems to know pretty quick that they're faking it, or he just, you know, just rolls with whatever they're saying. I don't know.
He's at least a little suspicious.
A little suspicious, sure. So they come up with the ruse that Sam's going to go in there and keep him occupied so Lila can walk around the house and find out what's going on and talk to Mother. Well, I just want to point out, Sam is the worst investigator and interrogator. You know, where Arbogast was great at it, Sam is awful. He just basically starts accusing him 5 seconds in.
I know. He's just like, oh, I'll just go and talk to him. I'll keep him busy or something like that. And I'm like, accusing him of the crime flat out is not keeping him busy.
Like, no, it's not.
She is up there breaking and entering, and you're going to give it all up. What's wrong with you?
Very, very bad interrogator. Do not get a job doing that, Sam. Well, he ends up getting clocked by Norman while Lila searches the house, which leads her to the fruit cellar because she finds Mother's room is empty, but there's an indent in the bed. And she's like, well, that's weird. Mom must be here somewhere. So she goes to the fruit cellar because why wouldn't you? And she meets Mother just as Norman arrives. And the big reveal, Norman has dressed as his mother and is there to kill her. But Sam arrives and stops Norman and prevents Lila from following suit with her sister's footsteps.
It's a pretty good reveal of Mother's corpse down there, sunken in eyes and everything. Like, she's been dead for a while and he's been keeping her around. Just the way it's shot, right? The way that the chair kind of just turns around, reveals that it's a corpse. And then Lila sort of jumps back and hits the light, which is hanging from the ceiling, puts kind of like a bit of movement on her face. Then, yeah, you see Norman come in the full mother garb, and the dude's insane. It's a little bit clumsy as he sort of like goes down and the wig and the dress opens up. Again, just a tiny little nitpick. It's like they really just wanted to sell that this is Norman dressed as Mother. So somehow we're going to have the wig fall off and everything.
You know, he didn't have time to pretty himself up.
I don't know, but I got it. Like, when he comes in, he's got the thing on. I'm like, that's Norman. He's dressed up. He's a loon.
Yeah. And I love how Sam gets knocked out really quick, but when he goes to get Norman, like, he can hold him solid.
He's a pretty big dude compared to...
Yeah, he is. The lanky little Norman. Yeah. So this is where we get the reveal. The psychologist goes and talks to a mother and comes back and explains that Norman Bates has a split personality and mother has officially taken over. Norman is no longer there, at least for all accounts and purposes.
Worst psychiatrist ever. No patient confidentiality or anything. Lila goes, oh, did he kill my sister? And he goes, yes. And no. And I'm like, just, her sister's dead, man. Like, come on.
And he doesn't even say your sister. He's like, the girl. Hey, he killed the girl. And she's over there like, oh my. Like, that's my sister, jackass. What?
Bedside manner. Keep a patient's privilege to yourself. Like,
yep.
No, he's got to explain everything. Matricide, split personalities, and all this kind of stuff.
But to be fair, he was the court psychiatrist. So, I mean... To be fair, I mean, he would have to report it to the police anyway. You know, he was basically
evaluating. There, though.
I don't know what the rules were in 1960. I don't know, but I know you probably shouldn't have been telling Lila and Sam all about it.
Exactly.
I mean, I still feel bad for Lila, though. It's like, that's when mother killed the girl. The girl? That was my sister! Again!
Human being.
Anyway, so we learn that Norman murdered his mother and her lover because her love for the man pushed Norman over the edge. Then he couldn't live with what he'd done, so he went and dug her corpse up, stole it, brought it back, sewed it up because he loves taxidermy, and acted as though mother were alive this whole time. That's our big reveal.
I think there was two other, like, missing persons, women on the books as well.
Young girls, yep.
Yeah, they're pretty sure they can associate that to him as well, so he's been doing this for a little while.
Absolutely. And we get one of the best closing shots in film history, where you have Norman looking at the camera, seemingly innocent Norman, who's taken over by his mother's commentary in his head. As he looks very horribly creepy up to the camera. And, you know, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Again, I mean, even this was foreshadowed with Marion in the car. As she's driving along and she's having all these thoughts. I always took it as in, like, she's thinking about, like, what's her boss going to say and all this sort
of
stuff.
Yeah, what's happening when I'm not there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's just going to play out in her mind. And now here we are at the end and we kind of get to see that the voice in Norman's head has actually taken control and starts talking about, like, how... Oh, it's so terrible that a mother has to turn on her son, but they'll put him away. You know, he's the one that's going away, not mother.
I'm fine. I'm just fine.
I love that dissolve shot where Norman's face bleeds into his mother's corpse's face, and then we get the car. I just love that shot.
You can almost just miss it because it happens during the crossfade into the shot of the car being dragged out of the swamp. So you got to really look at it closely because it only just sort of comes onto his face as it fades into the next shot.
That's the movie. I want to talk a little bit about the legacy before we get to the end of this episode. When did you first understand, Corey, the importance of Psycho as a film?
I think I pretty much understood it from the beginning of my deep dive into horror. You know, I've done podcasts before on one of my all-time favorite horror films, which is Scream, and also Halloween as well. All films that they owe everything to Psycho. Scream was the first horror film I ever saw, and that is a movie all about the history of horror films, right? Like, it mentions all the big horror films, and it was a good starting point for my interest in horror films because they name check so many of them. I could go back and watch them. Now, it did take me a while to get to Psycho and Hitchcock, but by the time I was there, I mean, I think the first time I watched it, I fully understood why this is the mother, if you will, of all horror films.
I remember when I first saw Halloween, you know, I saw it after I had already seen Psycho. And, you know, at the time I liked Psycho, but I was also young. So I didn't have a great appreciation for film at that time, you know, and I was like, why is this thing in black and white? So I watched Halloween and I remember hearing Sam Loomis's character's name and going, well, that's Psycho. And then, so I just started reading up on it and you see the history of it. And then I rewatched Psycho with a different eye, probably a more matured eye. I had grown in terms of what it was about film that I appreciated. I had started to learn more about Hitchcock. I had started to get a feel for his films and the kind of director he was and his impact. And then I started noticing after I rewatched Psycho again, a few years after that, like that's probably 10 or 11 or something. And I had a really strong passion for film at that time. And I would start watching horror movies and see the nods and the homages and the respect that movie had paid to so many horror films. Cause I'm a huge horror film fan and it's so across the board. I mean, you'll see the impact in movies that have nothing to do with slashers and it's still felt. Like Hitchcock's presence and how he directed this film and how the film told the story was still felt. You know, and there's so many movies like Dressed to Kill is a direct homage to Psycho. And so is Halloween. So are all the slasher movies. So are a ton of horror. It's just amazing to me as I grew up how many things still to this day are important nods to this film. Like this movie changed how horror films are made.
There's so many films where you can see just things as simple as a shot setup. You know, how do you film something? How do you get the right camera angle? That sort of thing. You know, it all comes back to what Hitchcock did in this film. His filmmaking, it echoed in horror films to this very day.
Yeah, and to this point, a lot of horror films were monster flicks. I mean, monster pictures were really popular back in this era. And this kind of exploded the whole slasher genre. I know you're a horror fan. Are you glad that the slasher genre became a thing and really launched from Psycho?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I mean, everybody's different. Some people that love horror movies don't like slasher films. I'm a huge fan of them. I don't know why.
I just name check them. Halloween and Scream. Number three is Psycho. Those are my three favorite horror films of all time. And it starts with Psycho. And the reason Halloween is so good, because John Carpenter was pretty much a student of Hitchcock, worshipped the ground he walked on, and mm-hmm. made a great film on the back of learning Hitchcock's technique. And then Scream, which paid homage to both of them. It all stems back to Psycho. It is the root of everything slasher film, for sure.
And another aspect, I mean, that people don't realize is it really utilized psychosis and psychology to explain the killer's motives, which especially has been prominent in the last couple decades. I mean, Hannibal Lecter's a great example. There's a lot of films where you could mention that, because this film is taking a person. You know, I talked about at that time, there's a lot of monster movies and stuff like that to elevate horror. And they were all, you know, Dracula, Wolfman, stuff like Frankenstein, stuff like that, where this took a normal man. And the reason he was crazy is because he broke mentally. And a lot of that is factually based in some sort of psychology. And I think it was based on Ed Gein at the time, you know, the original book was. And then you fast forward now and you have so many films that are telling these story, the same stories. And the biggest terror we ever see on screen anymore are real people. Like monsters aren't as terrifying anymore. Real people are far scarier, because now with true crime and everything else, we see, wow, that is the capacity of the mind, like to think of these things. Like there is depravity, and this really elevated that under a microscope.
I think what this film also reminds people is that you need to have the suspense, right? Like mm-hmm. I love a good cheesy slasher film. I will watch them till the cows come home. I love them because they have inventive kills and the blood splatter and all that kind of stuff. It's good fun. But the real great horror films, or the horror slashers, have the suspense element as well. And we say it all the time about Hitchcock, he is the master of suspense. You need to have that suspense element in there, because that is actually the truly terrifying part of it. It's the anticipation of what's going to happen before you get to the big violent outburst.
And speaking of, last thing in the legacy, Bernard Herrmann's string score and its lasting impact. I mean, to this day, it's very similar to Halloween in that respect. I mean, if you hear the Halloween theme, you have memories and visions in your head, right?
Just swap out the strings for the high end of a piano.
Isn't it fantastic?
Again, two of the most iconic scores in film history, for sure. Halloween and Psycho.
And they're connected.
I mean, they even connect it to Jaws. Instead of the high-pitched strings, you replace that with the low end of the piano. And you get mm-hmm. the Jaws theme.
That is true. Like Jaws, this is a very similar aspect of how it presents horror, which it keeps it very under the water for most of the movie. And then once it emerges, you know, it's a lot bigger than you expected. That was a weird connection, but I worked with it. All right. So some accompanying films we talked about. The Making of Psycho documentary is a great documentary. Janet Leigh is part of it. You can find it usually on the bonus features of the Psycho movie. 7852, which we talked about several times. It's on Hulu. If you have Hulu, you can watch it there. And you wanted to mention another one, which is a great find.
Yeah, Hitchcock from 2012. And it's pretty much, yeah, the dramatization of Hitchcock making Psycho. Great movie.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was fun seeing Hopkins play him.
Yeah, exactly. There's some good actors in there. Scarlett Johansson plays Janet Leigh.
Which I thought was a really good casting choice, which surprised me because I'm not a huge Scarlett Johansson fan, but I thought she was very good in that movie. She really captured Janet Leigh, I thought. Same smoky kind of voice. What was your quote of the picture?
Okay, it's got to be Norman Bates. We all go a little mad sometimes. I know it's totally cliched. There's no doubt about it. We all go a little mad sometimes. Tells you everything you need to know about the guy.
Yeah. And here's the thing. You know, when we do this format, Corey usually gets to it first because I wait till closer to it. I just like to have it fresh in my mind. So he got all the good quotes in this movie. He got all the best from looking at the format. I actually had three in there and you had them at different points. I'm like, yeah, son of a bitch. This sucks. This movie's so iconic. And I'm sure you, just like me, just pulled them off your head. You know, you don't even have to look them up.
You could have done the same one if that was your favorite.
That's fine. It's actually, I'm going to go with kind of a mini monologue, which is where Mother is talking in Norman's voice. And she's,
I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of person I am.
I'm a horrible Norma.
I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they're watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, well, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Nice. I actually do laugh every time when the cop comes in and goes, oh, he feels a little chill. Can I bring him a blanket? And he goes in there and all you hear is this, thank you.
I love that.
So funny.
And they're so polite to Norman, who just, you know, killed like five or six people that they know of.
All right, Hitchcock scale. I don't think it's going to be much of a surprise here. Master of suspense.
Master. Like I said before, you will watch the shot-for-shot remake of Psycho. I think you'll understand the original is the master of suspense. It just shows it. It's the director.
Say what you will about North by Northwest. Great movie. We talked about it. We gushed over it. Fantastic. He came back and he made this and proved that he hadn't peaked yet. This film, he put a lot of himself into it and he displayed every single aspect of everything he'd learned in his long career. It's a masterpiece.
Absolutely.
He's the master of suspense.
We got some feedback on this bad boy too. Let's talk about that and we will head on out of here.
Let's do it.
First up, we got Jennifer Miller and she said it's groundbreaking for a lot of reasons. It's a great black and white film for people who say they don't like black and white movies. That's a good point.
Yes, exactly. Proving Gus Van Sant wrong yet again. I heard that was one of the reasons why he made that movie. People don't go back and watch them and they don't like the black and white movies. I'll piss off. All right. We got an audio feedback from Jeff, X-Force 11. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Corey, Aaron, and Hitchcock fans. This is Jeff, X-Force 11, leaving my feedback for Psycho. This is a masterwork. It is so worthy to be covered in such details. I don't think you can go over this movie too much because of how deep Hitchcock got with the imagery and the themes. I'm just going to bring up a couple things. One, I enjoyed how Hitch contrasted the paranoia that Marion was going under and how he really showed it on screen and gave us a picture of her paranoia. And then he contrasts that with Norman's psychotic nature and how that those two things really drew these two people together. And that was a deadly thing for Marion. And I just loved how he looked at both of their issues and gave us insights into Norman's past, but not giving us the entire full picture. So we're still asking questions about why he is the way he is, because as much as we know, we don't know it all. And I want to really close with a summary I gave for Triple Cast episode 121 when Corey and Daryl went over this movie. I said, Hitchcock used black and white to push the boundaries. He plays with light and shadows to convey depth, menace, and so much more. He used Herman's scores to punch up the action. All in all, he's a master filmmaker and did not resort to gore to build suspense and make us afraid. This work is a piece of art. All right, X-Force 11 is out.
All right, thanks for that, Jeff. What else can we say? Total masterwork. Love it.
Yeah.
It,
well, he did say left. He was talking about asking, you're left asking questions. And I mean, you are, because when Psycho 2 came out, I couldn't wait to see that. and see where Norman was so many years later. And I actually thought that was a very good movie, too. I actually liked the Psycho sequels.
I mean, it's no Psycho the original, of course, but it's a pretty decent follow-up. Like, I'd recommend it for sure.
It's amazing that people, if you watch it, if you've never seen it before, basically, Norman's trying to be a good man the whole time. And then somebody just won't let him be.
It's an interesting story. It's a cool way to go. But hey, thanks for the shout out on the old Triple Cast show. It's
been thanks so much.
Few years since I retired that show, but yes, that's true. I did do a Psycho episode on there. All right, more audio feedback, of course, from the Unibeefer. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hello, everyone. The Unibeefer here. Now, Psycho is my favorite movie of all time, tied only with Clue. And it's a mad, 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 mad world. To say I spent my teens obsessed with this movie is very easily an understatement. In fact, my fondest memory of my childhood is a 13-year-old me being allowed off the tram at the backlot tour at Universal Studios Hollywood, just so I can run down the steps to the motel, saying, "No, mother, no, blood, blood," while my real mother stood there shaking her head in her hands. Anyways, weirdly, it's not my favorite Hitchcock film, which would be The Trouble with Harry. But it is one of my top three favorite films of all time, so I'll let you do the math there. Overall, it's just a classic. I think you'd be really hard-pressed to find someone who hasn't seen the film, or at least hasn't heard of it. It may very well be one of the most iconic films of all time. I could go on for hours about Psycho, so I'm just gonna sum up and say, I love this movie. I just love this movie. So until next time, thank you, and we all go a little mad sometimes, haven't you?
Yeah, it was funny. This audio feedback came through and the accompanying email pretty much just said, I rambled in my phone for about an hour and it took me forever to cut it down to a minute of feedback. I'm like, of course it did. But thank you for keeping it to around that minute mark.
That's funny. That's
man, funny. I am so jealous that he actually got to go up to the house and be at the foot of the stairs at the Universal backlot. I have taken the Universal tour and seen the Bates Motel and everything, but yeah, we didn't get to go up there. Man, I would have loved that.
I was there too. I went there when I was 20 years old, 21. I could drink at that time, so I had to be 21.
I was a bit younger because my parents took me.
It's an amazing thing to see. Actually, I don't even think the house is there anymore, but it was an amazing thing to see. It was just such a piece of film history. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I know. It's a vivid memory from my trip out there.
Last feedback. Randy Westcott said, funny story about this one. In 1960, my grandma gave my dad money to walk downtown with his younger brother to either the Coronado or Times in our local area to watch Dumbo. The other theater was playing Psycho, so they chose that option instead. Big difference. And because of this, until his death in 2006, my dad would not take a shower unless someone else was home with him. I can't count the times I'd visit and he'd say, can you hang out for a few minutes so I can go get a shower?
Wow.
Isn't that fantastic?
I've never been like that, though, you know? Like, I've watched a horror movie and, you know, it scared me, or it's actually kind of hard to scare me with horror films now because I'm a horror film aficionado, but I don't think I've ever been so freaked out by a movie that I've not wanted to do something.
Never?
No. It's never, like, showers have never bothered me after watching Psycho or... I don't know. I'm trying to think of another scenario. Like, watched Hereditary. Now people can't ride in the backseat of my car.
Well, don't stick your head out the window and I think you'll be just fine.
Spoiler alert for that movie.
I couldn't go to a beach forever after Jaws. It was probably a good 10 years.
See, still didn't bother me. And I live in Australia. Like, there's friggin' killer sharks everywhere.
The killer sharks everywhere. They're just there. You get used to them. Doesn't bother me. Whatever. Swim.
Exactly. We've got land sharks in Australia, so you don't even have to go in the water. The sharks will kill you. That's not true.
Land shark.
We all have pet kangaroos, though. That is true.
Obviously. I mean, that's why I tell people. Yeah. I got a buddy in Australia. He's got a kangaroo. That's what he said. Let's draw the next one. I mean, we tackled this masterpiece. What could possibly be next?
FYI, I have left Psycho in the hat so we can figure out when we would have randomly drawn it.
Oh, that's cool. All right.
So that might show up at some point in the future. But no, let's draw the next one. And it is 1941, Suspicion.
Ooh, I like that one. That's good.
I'm not sure if I've seen Suspicion. I don't think so.
Well, you're about to enjoy. Not one of his best ones, but it's a really good one. Some people love it.
Anyway, do you want to hit us with a Hitchcock out?
Yes. All right, guys. Now it's time for the Hitchcock out. And this is where, when we're leaving the show, we want to leave you with a quote from the master himself. So here's a quote to connect to Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock once said, "I have a perfect cure for a sore throat. Cut it."
Love it.
Love it. But you know what? Let's go with something a little bit more in depth for his greatest film. He said, and this is a direct quote from Alfred Hitchcock himself, "Violence on the screen increases violence in people only if those people already have sick minds. I once read somewhere that a man admitted killing three women, and he said he had killed the third woman after seeing Psycho. Well, I wanted to ask him what movie he had seen before he killed the second woman. And then we'd ban that movie. Don't you see? And then if we found out that he'd had a glass of milk before he killed the first woman, why, then we'd have to outlaw milk, too. Wouldn't we? At a screening of Psycho, a young boy came up to me. He was about 9 or 10. And he said to me, 'What did you use for blood? Chicken blood?' And I said, 'No, I used chocolate sauce.' The point is that he said, 'What did you use?' He knew it was a movie, that it was pretend." Still a relevant quote, even today, the way people blame movies and TV and video games for things. Alfred Hitchcock's always ahead of the curve. You know what? That's it for this episode of Presenting Hitchcock, Corey. Don't forget, you can send us your feedback at presentinghitchcock@gmail.com. Please join our social medias, facebook.com/groups/HitchcockPod. So find Presenting Hitchcock on Facebook. You can join our group and we'll talk about Hitchcock. Or we're on Twitter @HitchcockPod. Also, your rating reviews are always appreciated on your podcast app of choice. If you could just hit the stars. Thank you.
All right. A great conversation on Psycho. I'm surprised we didn't go 3 hours on this episode, but
I could have. If you want to go some more, we can talk up more.
I know. This you don't want to gush too much, right?
We did. I think we covered all the bases. My God, there's so much trivia. You know, it's hard to find any trivia that isn't pretty well known on this movie. This is a pretty well documented film.
All right, let's get out of here, and that will leave me to say, until next time, a boy's best friend is his mother.
You know, Corey, you might have fooled me, but you didn't fool my mother.
Presenting Hitchcock, Corey and Aaron, not associated with the copyright holders of these pictures, and no copyright infringement is intended. The use of copyrighted material is protected under United States Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com has graciously provided the delightful score for this wonderful show. We hope you enjoy. See you again soon.